I'm Chris Reback.
And I'm Tegan Goddard.
You're listening to the free version of Trial Balloon.
Visit trialballoon.fm to get new episodes every week and more.
Tegan, are you overdoing it or do you think that you have it under control?
I am definitely overdoing it, Chris.
You're definitely overdoing it. Do you want to take a guess on the topic?
What is the topic, Chris?
Watching the Hush Money trial, or at least following the play-by-play updates.
That would be fact check true, Chris. I am glued to every live blog I can find from the courtroom. Oh my goodness, is it a trial?
Is it more interesting, engaging than you thought it would be?
As we record, we have had the 3 days of David Pecker, the former publisher of National Enquirer, testifying, and it is fascinating how deeply involved he was in this catch and kill stuff, where he would essentially buy the rights to stories and then just kill it on behalf of powerful people, whether that's Donald Trump, who was obviously a presidential candidate and then president, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, or even Rahm Emanuel, Barack Obama's former chief of staff, the former mayor of Chicago, and the current ambassador to Japan. David Pecker said he killed stories for all of those people.
Catch and kill has certainly become the phrase of the week. Another phrase of the week is split screen. And let me run through something that you wrote. If the first week is any indication, Donald Trump's hush money trial is going to be a real problem for his presidential campaign. Trump will be forced to sit in a freezing Manhattan courtroom week after week. He'll be watching the reactions of jurors who will decide his fate, at least if he can stay awake. Each day, he'll leave the courthouse and rant to the media about the unfair proceedings, which are an assault on the country. Meanwhile, the cable news networks will be covering the salacious details from the day's proceedings about how Trump had an affair with the Playboy model and porn star while his wife was pregnant. Sure, Trump's hardcore supporters will continue to support him, but it's impossible to see how any of this helps him win over swing voters. Meanwhile, President Biden will be doing his job as president. As he did this week, Biden will be coordinating the international response to Iran's attack on Israel. He'll be barnstorming swing states like Pennsylvania, talking about his economic agenda, and he'll be winning important endorsements like that of the Kennedy family. No one pays more attention to how he's covered on television than Trump. He knows this split screen is not good for his campaign. That's what you wrote earlier this week and last week. And then today, Stuart Stevens writes in the New York Times a piece titled, "Being Stuck in a Courtroom is Just What Trump Needed." For the next several weeks, the presumptive Republican nominee for president will be spending his days in a New York City courthouse. By any normal campaign standard, taking your candidate off the road for much of April and May of a presidential year would be devastating. But Normal and Donald Trump live in different countries. The trial will afford Mr. Trump the opportunity to defend the essence of his candidacy. I am a victim. The very competent operatives running the Trump campaign didn't draw this up as their ideal plan, but they will appreciate its potential. The Manhattan courtroom will be the setting for Mr. Trump to play the role of a familiar American archetype. The wronged man seeking justice from corrupt, powerful forces. The former president is good in this role, and that's no small thing. My question, because I know that you are a fan of Stevens, as am I, is he wrong? Is this trial good or bad for Trump?
I don't think Stu Stevens is correct in this case, because I don't think Trump comes off so much as the victim as he comes off as whiny and weak. The other thing that Stevens said in his piece, which is certainly interesting and worthy of reading, was that somehow Donald Trump's campaign rallies are not capturing the attention anymore, and that by being at a courthouse, you're guaranteeing Trump coverage. Now, I don't think that Donald Trump is going to lack for coverage anytime he's running for president. I think he'll always get coverage. So Stevens is almost thinking like this is actually a good thing that Trump has television cameras to play to every single day when court is over. And I just don't think that Donald Trump will ever have that problem. He's always been such a train wreck of a candidate. He says something ridiculous and everyone's there and everyone's talking about it. I personally think that when Trump comes out of that trial every day and he talks to reporters, first of all, he's not doing himself any favors by talking to reporters because his words can be used against him potentially in this criminal trial, but he just comes off as weak. And I really think that Trump's candidacy is not about being the victim, as Stevens says. I think it's always been about being strong and being commanding. And I think that's the advantage that he has over Joe Biden, who he's portrayed as elderly and not with it, possibly with dementia, that type of thing. Donald Trump has always been that strong guy. He projects strength. And when you're stuck in a courtroom and a judge won't let you do anything, judge won't even let you go to the bathroom, that does not show a very strong candidate. It shows one who's quite weak.
Hasn't that always been the contradiction that, yes, at the same time that he portrays himself as strong or tries to portray himself as strong or as a strong man, et cetera, he does portray himself as a victim. Things are so unfair. And I agree with you. He absolutely seeks to be strong and with it in contrast to Biden or to anyone else. But he does play both sides of that coin. I'm wondering as well, in thinking about what Stu Stevens wrote and what you just said, is it possible that there are two benefits for Trump getting only, let's say, a minute 30, 2 minutes of post-courtroom trial, standing there with the stack of papers and his attorney behind him, commentary before the cameras, which seem to now be playing the entirety of what he says. Each night, whatever he says out there, I feel like I'm seeing the whole take. Two potential benefits vis-a-vis the rallies. One is, it's a change of scenery. We've all seen him at the rallies. You know, at some point, the TV show becomes boring. Now you're seeing him in a different scene. I would agree, at some point, standing outside the courtroom, that becomes boring too. But it's only going to be 2-3 days a week for 6 weeks. It provides a bit of a change in scenery for your nightly programming. Second thing is, and you've written about this quite a bit, you've argued his rallies are insane time. The stuff that he's been going off and saying in those is really, really off the rails. And, you know, if he's not off the rails at the rallies, then he can just make his statements for a contained, call it 2 minutes, outside the courtroom. So is it possible that those two things, one, the change in scenery, two, being forced to avoid going off the rails at rallies, maybe that's supportive of Stu Stevens' points?
I do think you have a point about the change of scenery. I mean, obviously, being outside a courthouse because your criminal trial has happened in there, that is definitely a change of scenery. I just don't think it's a great change of scenery. You know, it's like if you had your choice of all the places you could be seeing, being outside of a courthouse where you're being tried on 34 felony counts is probably not the best place.
Unless you're a victim.
Do Americans really want a victim as their president of the United States? I don't think
more than 50% do. I agree with you.
I mean, I have a good friend who has this theory of likable strength. And his view is that the candidate who wins is the one who combines likability with strength. And I think that if you had to choose these two candidates, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, Joe Biden is clearly the more likable person. All the people who work for Trump or come in touch with him don't even like him. But Trump has come off as the stronger candidate generally. And certainly when Biden was being portrayed a couple months ago as this very old man and all of the news reports every single night were how slowly Biden walks and all the rest, that played into Trump's advantage. What my point is in writing that piece this week was that Trump in the courtroom, as we record this today, there was the Supreme Court hearing on his immunity complaint. Donald Trump says he wanted to be in Washington at the Supreme Court, but the judge here in Manhattan would not let him leave his criminal trial for that. Donald Trump can't choose to where he wants to go. Donald Trump can't talk in the courtroom. Donald Trump can't say certain things because he's under a gag order. None of this makes him seem strong. In fact, it makes him seem weak. When you go back to where he made his fame as star of The Apprentice, the whole idea that you could sit there at the boardroom table, point at the employee across the table and say, "You're fired," that's an image of strength. Donald Trump doesn't have that right now. Instead, it's the judge pointing his finger at Trump, telling him to be quiet. It's a very different thing. Although, to your point about the change in scenery, Trump did try to mix it up this morning by showing up at a construction site in Midtown Manhattan where the JP Morgan building is going up and talking with workers there. And I do think that that was, to Stevens's point and to the point you were making, that's what Trump was trying to accomplish there. I think he was trying to do something so he's not always at the courthouse. So I would expect that each day of this trial, Donald Trump will have a stop in the morning somewhere where he can actually actually try to campaign or try to have a setting, because it's true, before he goes to trial every day, there will be reporters there who will want him to talk, who want him to make comments. And even though his lawyers are probably telling him, don't say anything, Donald Trump is almost certainly going to say something.
There will be reporters who want to help him break his gag order.
Exactly. They'll be talking about Michael Cohen or David Pecker or whoever.
The other Trump hush money trial question that I have been wanting to ask you for a couple of weeks now, it first came to me, I saw the Jesse Waters segment on Fox News when the jurors were being seated. I think he did this when the first seven were seated. And he just went through the biographical bullet points of the various jurors and broke into laughter after each one, saying that, well, that person clearly can't be fair. That person can't be fair. That person can't be fair. Just going through one by one. Could you be an impartial juror in the Trump hush money trial?
It's an interesting question. And as a New Yorker, I was actually thinking, oh, wouldn't that be interesting if you were called for jury duty and you happen to show up and it was the Trump trial and they start going through all of your social media and internet postings? Well, I think that if Donald Trump's lawyers read what I've written, I don't think I would make it very far through this process. Theoretically, could I be impartial? If I'm being completely honest, I don't think I could be. I think Donald Trump is guilty of so much, including the counts in this trial, that I don't think that I would be able to weigh the evidence. It's not to say that I don't find it fascinating. This week has been absolutely fascinating in terms of David Pecker talking about the catch and kill schemes and how they were implemented and how Trump and Michael Cohen set them up. I mean, I think it's unbelievably interesting. There's so much more I want to know. I'd be really curious to know if David Pecker will actually start talking to the media or write a book, because what he has admitted to as the publisher of the National Enquirer is extraordinary, because most of us really only knew it as the publication that would be in the checkout line and we'd read about Hillary Clinton's alien baby or other things. You would be surprised at this, Chris, perhaps, is that David Pecker admitted in the trial that they make up stories in the National Enquirer. Did you know that?
Shocking. Shocked to learn that.
Could you be impartial, Chris?
I do believe that I could. I believe that I could separate out any sentiments or preconceived notions about the person or behaviors or actions in other things and look at the black and white question of, were crimes committed in this case based on the evidence? With a definition of what is illegal, which I would assume is part of the instruction that is given to the jury. This is the law. If X occurred, that is not legal. If Y occurred, that is legal. And go determine what occurred. I do think I could do that. I do think I could.
Well, it's too bad you didn't get a chance, Chris, because I would have loved to have a source on that jury that I could get fresh feedback on what's going on in that trial. Because I have to say, following live blogs is just not nearly enough for me. I'm mainlining this trial.
It is a fascinating trial. As you know, I would not say anything to you during the trial, but I do promise that if I had been on there, I would have used Trial Balloon as my first interview stop after the trial. I would not have gone elsewhere. I would have gone straight here.
Outstanding. Well, maybe there, you know, Donald Trump has a few more trials left. Maybe you could be called for the jury on one of them. If
we'll
so,
see what happens.
That's a promise to listeners.
Moving on, do we have in Mike Johnson the most powerful House Speaker since Nancy Pelosi? And here's why.
Wow, that's a softball question. He is absolutely the most powerful speaker since Nancy Pelosi. Sorry, Kevin McCarthy.
I thought you would like the framing. But here's why I ask such a provocative question. Frank Bruni this week in the New York Times wrote, "For the sake of democracy, celebrate Mike Johnson. We've seen movies aplenty in which a deeply flawed protagonist, someone we'd pretty much given up hope on, has a stirring of conscience or a change of heart and puts his immediate interests at risk for the sake of something bigger. The music swells, the credits roll. I never expected the music to swell and the credits to roll with Mike Johnson's face in the center of the frame." That was after, of course, getting the Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan bills through the House. And in the face of threats by Marjorie Taylor Greene and others to bring a motion to vacate. Meanwhile, Playbook this week wrote a piece headlined, Trump to MTG, give it a rest. First, Mike Johnson got his aid packages passed. Then he sat by as Trump told Marjorie Taylor Greene to pipe down. Turns out it wasn't a momentary lapse of judgment. Donald Trump defended Johnson for the second time in as many weeks amid a swirl of speculation about his future atop the House GOP. The former president said Johnson is, quote, trying very hard and is, quote, a very good person. The quote continued. Well, look, we have a majority of one, okay, Trump said, extending Johnson some grace and echoing the speaker's own explanation for working with Democrats on a host of issues. It's not like he can go and do whatever he wants. Trump even praised Johnson for turning some foreign aid to Ukraine into a loan and for standing, quote, very strong with me on urging NATO countries to up their defense spending commitments. The remarks come just a day after Greene vowed on Fox News to force Johnson out one way or the other, and just hours after MAGA chieftain Steve Bannon claimed that Trump was in fact, quote, furious about what had happened with Johnson's support of foreign aid spending and that he'd been manipulated by, quote, cuck political operatives, end quote, into backing the rookie speaker. So is that it? Most powerful since Nancy Pelosi. I'm going to wager that you're not going to say that he's the most powerful since even before Nancy Pelosi. But let me ask it slightly differently. Does Mike Johnson have power?
That's a great question. You know, I wrote last week about how Mike Johnson had given away the Republican majority because the only way he can get anything passed in this house of his is because his own caucus is so fractured, is to rely on Democratic votes. Interestingly enough, when you do things that Democrats want, you might actually have power, and Democrats seem willing to stand by and to save Mike Johnson should a motion to vacate come up. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene keeps saying she's going to bring it up, she's going to force him out, he should resign, and Mike Johnson stands firm knowing that the Democrats have his back. So I don't think Mike Johnson ever really pictured this scenario where his power would be guaranteed by Democrats instead of his own caucus, but that's really what seems to have happened here. So he does have power because he remains the Speaker of the House, but it's only because he's kind of got this bipartisan coalition, unofficial bipartisan coalition going. We'll see how long it lasts. But if he does things that Democrats want to do, like Ukraine aid or Israel aid, then yeah, he's got some power.
It's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, understanding new approaches to power and how power can come suddenly, surprisingly, I don't know that that's unique to politics, but it's a special aspect of politics that sometimes things happen and suddenly one finds oneself in a situation where power accrues and he does seem to have it. We'll see what he does with it. He used some of it this week to go to Columbia University and call for the Columbia University president's resignation. That felt like a bit of a strange way to take a victory lap from what he had done previously from those aid packages and having just secured more power. I did find it really, really interesting, and a reminder of part of what I like about politics, for better and worse, is the story of how power gets created and can accrue, sometimes surprisingly.
You know, let's take a little aside to talk about what Mike Johnson was doing by going to Columbia and what Republicans are doing generally by encouraging police and universities to get tough on these protests that are happening at all of these universities around the country. If you go back 4 years ago to the spring of 2020, we had something very similar that was working for Republicans, which was the Black Lives Matter protests. And Republicans made hay of that. That's when Republicans were encouraging people to break up these marches, to stop protesters from blocking streets. And they found that as a very good rallying cry. That's what I think Mike Johnson is trying to do here. That's what I think Republicans are trying to do here, is they're trying to galvanize people against protests, very much like they did with Black Lives Matter. And it's a different type of protest, but there are some commonalities, obviously. Protests which are on behalf of Palestinians in Gaza, who are, you know, under attack essentially from Israel. It is the same type of thing. And I think Republicans see this as a way to rally their supporters. So that's what I think Mike Johnson's up to. It just occurred to me today that it was very similar to what was going on just 4 years ago.
I think that you're right on that. I think also he's doing that because it's part of their campaign against elite universities and against the elite. And just, you know, there's the hope to be able to get another scalp like they got from Penn and Harvard presidents and elsewhere. I would also point you to, did you read David Leonhardt's column this morning, his newsletter, The Morning? I thought this, to your point, and I thought this was a really excellent framing. The piece is called Chaos and Oppression. The central question for universities responding to protests is whether to prioritize the preservation of order or the desire of students to denounce oppression. And he writes, Arnold Kling, an economist, published a book a decade ago that offered a way to think about the core difference between progressives and conservatives. Progressives, Kling wrote, see the world as a struggle between the oppressor and the oppressed, and they try to help the oppressed. Conservatives see the world as a struggle between civilization and barbarism, between order and chaos, and they try to protect civilization. Like many frameworks, Kling's is a simplification, and it's easy to find exceptions. But his book has been influential because the framework often sheds light on political arguments. The debate over pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia and other universities has become an example. If you want to understand why university leaders are finding the situation so hard to resolve, Kling's dichotomy is useful. The central question for colleges is whether to prioritize the preservation of order or the desire of students to denounce oppression. He makes great arguments for both parts of that framework. And you can understand it because, you know, you find yourself saying, well, yes, of course, standing up against oppression, if that's what you believe, well, you know, of course one feels that way. And yet to what you were saying, comparing it to 4 years ago, yes, conservatives are arguing for law and order. I mean, how many times did you see Trump calling for law and order and we can't have chaos? And the arguments for that, there are, in my opinion, very reasonable arguments for that because it becomes a question of whose priorities win. You know, what's the point of having rules in society if we aren't agreeing to some of those rules and playing by them? Anyhow, I recommend reading the piece because I thought it outlined an interesting approach to think about the framework and why, to great extent, so many folks in trying to define what's going on very easily can be talking past each other.
Yeah, no, very interesting point. I will read that column and we'll put a link in the show notes.
My only regret in raising that piece to you and suggesting that maybe you take a look at it.
What's that, Chris?
I fear it's going to take away from your time watching the Trump hush money trial. I really don't want to ruin that for you.
Believe me, I'm not going to start reading that piece until after the trial's over. So anyway, there's more trial tomorrow, Chris.
Okay. Talk to you in 6 weeks then, Tegan.
Talk to you later. Bye, Chris.